All right. Yeah, I don't know if if we've ever talked about predictability, taking uncertainty out of it by making the next call from you predictable is a way of building trust, because you take away the word trust and you put in predictability, then you build trust. That is something I don't know that we've really talked that much, Steve, with you about. That was how we built rapport and calm kidnap victim families down. And then I found out that there was an agent in Australia, probably about 5 years ago, that's exactly what she was doing. And her referral rate was far in excess of anybody else's. And she said, we have scheduled calls with clients, and they know when we're nobody ever wonders when they're going to hear from us. And because of that, they trust us. So that's you
Yeah.
tumbling to that is brilliant. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. Probably going farther than you realize, but as you just described, a higher level of customer service.
Yeah. And it started out to really just put the boundaries around my day off, and it turned into like the weekly wrap up. And yeah, I know my clients appreciate it.
Yeah, and it has to have a massive impact on your referral pipeline. You feel like you're looking out for them.
Yep.
The thing I would like Regina to talk about, this concept that she came up with called putting guardrails around her business. And maybe Regina, you could speak to that. And what are the certain guardrails you've put in place?
Yeah, so it's interesting because Steve has me lead his call on some Wednesdays. And I think that's where I first used that phrase. Yes, hold on for just a second. So guardrails. So, one of the things that I'm extremely consistent in my business. I'm consistent in what I do every day. I tend to obey my calendar more times than not. I tend to do routine. But this is a 24/7 business if we let it, it's a 24/7 business if we let it. The clients will call us, the agent, it's really, the only people who really violate my hours are the other agents. They're the ones that get mad. Like, what are these hours? So the guardrails protect me. They're boundaries. They keep me from going off the rails, right? They keep me from running around like a crazy person, trying to chase down everything that doesn't need to be done right now. Not everything is urgent. I don't need to, and I don't need to do all of it. Like, I have people to help with all of this stuff. Assistants, buyer's agents, marketing people. I have support to do all of this stuff. So my guardrails are like my work hours. That's the first one, right? Those are my work hours. I have other guardrails where I turn my cell phone off at night. It's not on silent. It's off. Completely off at night. And I'd like to get it 12 hours. I'm only down to like 10 right now. I got to get it back to 12 hours because that is a nice break. Like 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. Have that phone off. I'm a super early riser. So like I woke up at about 4 today. Maybe I got up around 4:15. I don't look at the phone till much later in the morning. It's not the first thing that I do. I don't want to look at my phone first thing in the morning. Like, those are my guardrails. I work out every day. I have to work out because I'm a frenetic, high energy, high stress, high anxiety sort of baseline, and working out really tempers all of that stuff. And so that's something that I make time for every day. And those things, right? Those are the things that keep me even. I'm not an even keeled person, but it keeps me like employable, It keeps me normal enough, And those are the things that, like, if I violate those things, it goes back to that sort of doormatting feeling. I don't want to talk to people at 9 o'clock at night, at 10 o'clock at night. When someone texts me at 10 o'clock at night, in the days when my phone used to be on first thing in the morning, I would text them back at 4:30. Like, sorry, hope your phone's off. So the guardrails are the things that keep me like even keeled. And I think most of them, Steve, are like around my schedule. It's like every day it's the same thing. I get up at like 4:30. I sit around for an hour and drink coffee. I have quiet time, maybe a little meditation. I read these little meditation books. I chill with the dog. It's quiet. You know, there's no one around. The phone isn't ringing. No one's bugging me. That's a guardrail for me. That's protected space for me. And then I do my workout, and then I get on the 8 o'clock call. Then I have an 8:30 meeting with my team. And then 9 o'clock is breakfast. Around 9:30, I get on the phone. Every single day is like that. Unless I have an exception, I will deal with, and the next day will be like that. And then at night, it's the same thing. I have my same wind down thing. My phone goes off at 6. I have my certain routine at night. I want to get all of these things sort of done because it's a nice bookend to my day. And then I try to really go to bed early every night. You know, I heard, what's his name? The chef, Jeffrey Sod.
He said
there's two types of successful people, those that wake up naturally at 5 and those that have to set an alarm. And I'm like, that's a guardrail for me. Like, I go to bed early and I get up early. You know, first off, I have no social life, and that's by design. I don't mind that. I like a quiet life when I'm not in real estate. But I want to make sure that I'm just taking care of all of that other stuff around me, you know, so that I can like function in a very high stress environment. And I'm functioning in an environment where, you know, our clients are extremely needy. You know, Right. There's people are selling and buying real estate because someone died, because they got divorced. You know, that's not always fun. And sometimes it's a job change, or they got married, or they had a baby, and it is fun, but it's always high stress. And they have a lot of needs for our time and attention. And I have to be able to perform to that and have the energy available. You know, sometimes I talk about my clients as a box of mewling kittens, all need. And if myself, I can't take care of them.
Well, and it was something I heard recently. It talked about the more that you can basically wall yourself off from people, the more you can be compassionate. You need a break. You need to recharge. And if you really want to be there for people, you have to carve out time where you're not there for them. And you're doing exactly that. You're giving them more compassion and more service by putting those guardrails up.
When I'm fried and overwhelmed, I'm queen bee, and it's not pleasant, you know, it's not pleasant. Right. And my job is to, you know, try to minimize the emergence of my alter ego, you know, and I have enough sleep, you know, getting enough sleep, like having time off. And that thing, like being away from people, it hits home because my mornings, it's solitude. I enjoy my solitude. It's very restorative. Right. And then the other things that are guardrails that aren't so much about like my physical and mental health are just about like my work schedule. You know, I like to tell people the truth. I like to give them, I like to prepare them for the truth. I don't like skirt around difficult conversations. That's a guardrail. I can't leave things unsaid that need to be said to the client because it's an uncomfortable conversation. Recently, I've been getting a lot of, being hired by people whose listings have expired with another agent. Okay. Now, these aren't things that I seek out. There are agents who, you know, go after expired listings. It's not been my practice, but I get a lot of those inbound calls. And what I'm learning about why the listings expire is because the agent has not had the tough conversation with the seller, at least half the time. Sometimes it's the seller. Sometimes the seller won't hear it. But what I'm hearing is a lot of the times the stuff that needs to be said isn't even being brought up. And so I don't like to leave those things undone. And using like, again, what I'm learning with you, Chris, and with Steve is, you know, preparing people for bad news. You know, Right. Allowing them to be in the right headspace to hear something that they, you know, may not want to hear.
Right.
So it's all of those things. It's really like, what should I be doing? And then, you know, do it.
Amen.
Yep.
And the favorite and the fool, that is a guardrail. You know, that protects you from doing stuff you don't need to do.
Yeah, it protects me from chasing. Chasing is burnout mode, right? If I don't want to be overwhelmed, crazy queen bee, I can't chase. If I'm chasing, it will immediately put me in that spot because it's a very frustrating spot to be in. You're always trying to find out, what do I need to say? What do I need to do to get this business? It's like, I don't want to be in that position. Knowing whether I'm the favorite or the fool allows me to take a step back from all of that and not wonder, you know, what should I not pour over in my head over and over again? What should I have said? What did I do wrong? I don't have to do any of that stuff. Like, it frees up a lot of mental space when I understand whether I'm the favorite or the fool.
Yeah, it's a fear-driven life otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly being feared. Wow. What a miserable place to be.
Yeah.
Identifying elf and half clients. Best way to do that is going to be with proof of life. Just as a reminder for those of you that may have missed it, accusations are to fall by proof of life. That's going to be the beginning of starting to identify if they're elf or they're half. Right? An elf client is probably going to have a good response for you. Well, you guys are the best. You got a great reputation. Half client is probably going to be like, isn't that why you're here? Aren't you here to tell me why we should do business with you? Probably half. Going to the virtual environment thing, right? And I know we've had a couple of comments in there. Zoom is much more efficient. And the reality is it is, right? I've got to get on a plane, spend 3 hours in the air one way just to sit down and have this meeting. I can jump on Zoom, be done in 20 minutes, and then get on to the next call, right? And so I think as the generations begin to change, right, Zoom will become much more of a staple. But I think just to Chris's mention in the simile, as it were, between when electric cars came on the scene versus putting gas cars out of business, right? The prediction was going to happen right away, and still isn't even really that close to this day. Same thing I think is going to happen with Zoom. But the one thing to remember, I think all of you are feeling this, which is why we're having this class, right? Building a relationship from scratch on Zoom is very difficult to do. Maintaining a relationship on Zoom is not as difficult, but starting from scratch. And so the thing that I will caution you on is we always kind of make up what we think of people when we get a chance to finally see them. In my experience, when I've met people on virtually and then got a chance to see them in person, they're usually so shocked by my size and how my vibe is very different in person that it throws them off. And so I know this based on repetitions. And so I'm prepared for it if that is in fact the sequence of our engagements. And it will somewhat prepare them for that moment. Like, don't be shocked when a big light-skinned guy in all black comes walking down the street towards you, right? Don't turn and run, right? Or something, like I'll make some sort of a joke about it to set it up. Cause I don't look very big for those of you that know, like I'm not a huge guy, but I'm 6'2" and I'm 325. I don't look quite like that on camera. So it surprises people. Incorporate that into your interactions. If you know it's coming, right? Don't let them get sideswiped by it. Make a joke about it ahead of time or use it as your accusations on it. Right? Like a lot of people, it's weird when you meet them for the first time in person, right? You never expect them to actually look the way that they do. Ah, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, right? Make it part of your accusations audit. And then in regards to the walk away, right? We all know that the walk away can be powerful because it's a decent way to inject fear of loss in someone. Now, fear of loss is a good thing. It's very powerful. The oxytocin here and now moment that Chris talked about earlier today is more powerful than the walk away. And so probability wise, right? We know common ground is great, but tactical empathy gets to trust faster. Same idea, walk away might get you the deal, but there's a really good chance you're gonna wanna make a deal for if you've created oxytocin for them in the moment. And so That's an alternative. And if you can shape your walk away to be fed by your oxytocin, it makes your walk away that much stronger. Because if you've created the bond, you turning and walking away after a bond is created, it's that much more difficult to let you out the door. And so my quick example of this, back when I was in my younger years, I used to love going, I lived in Newark, New Jersey. I used to love going downtown to do all my shopping because they had all like the name brand stuff for like dirt cheap, right? So I used to love going down there. And I used to love the walk away until I figured out that if I could create a quick bond of, I know you hate people walking in off the street into your place of business to try to tell you that your price is too high, right? And it's currently too high for me. And I follow that up with, I appreciate you showing me this. Unfortunately, it's not something that I'm looking for. Knowing that they're willing to bargain over their price. And before I can even get all the way turned around, $20 has now turned into $15. $30 is $20. Just because the bond is there and I've identified, you're tired of dealing with these idiots. They walk in here and they go, give me this 40 thing for 20 bucks. How about, let me get the 5 for $20. You guys got that, right? They're tired of that crap. And so identifying that I understand that's a problem for them creates the bond, and then following up with, unfortunately, I'm in the same boat they are. Right? I came in just to see what I could work. Obviously, you don't need nobody telling you what your prices should be. Wait. We can do 5 for $20 just for you, though. Just for you, right? Now, all of a sudden, I'm getting the discount without having to ask for it. So things to keep in mind, right? And we're constantly talking about things. There's a lot to keep in mind, right? Your brain can get full real quick. But things to continue to think about as you work your way towards REAP. And I know many of you are working your way that direction if you're not already there. And so things to continue to contemplate, as it were.
I could keep this conversation going forever. I got one more question that I'm personally curious about. You talk a lot about mirroring, where you say the last three words of what somebody says and the power of that, and then you just shut up. The mirroring versus layering. Example, when you object, okay, or when you say something that's like, look, we don't have the budget for this, right? Mirroring is, so you don't have the budget. Sit, let it sit. So, layering would be, help me understand, what do you mean by you don't have the budget? Is one more powerful than the other? Because what you're both trying to do is get them to talk more and really uncover the true like meaning behind what they're saying there. Is there a difference between that? And do you see one as more valid than the other in certain circumstances?
To begin with, if you're at the point where somebody says, we don't have the budget, and you say, help me understand, what do you mean by you don't have the budget? You're telling them that you have not been paying attention up to now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, I use that as a kind of a very simple example, but you just see what I'm saying, like layering questions to say, tell me more about that. Could you explain to me, could you give me an example of versus.
Hold it. By the first thing you said, tell me more about that. It's not a question, it's a command. And then you followed up with two straight yes oriented questions, which are trap questions.
Okay.
But nobody wants to say yes to anything.
Okay.
So you hit me with what, three straight bad communication techniques.
Okay.
Right off the bat. Tell me more about that is not a question, it's a command. It's a grab for autonomy. It's an attempt to take control of a conversation. Taking control is taking away somebody's autonomy, which we will die to preserve our autonomy.
But don't, when you talk about calibrated questions, isn't, don't you talk about how you want to make the illusion of them in control when you're actually in command?
We want to have the upper hand. We don't want to have control.
Okay.
And I'll tell you something else. We don't try to get information by asking questions. We use questions to shape thoughts. Questioning to gather information is a third of the people that you run into will be so-so with it, and two-thirds of them are not going to like it at all. The very analytical person, every time you ask them a question, they stop and they think, I have to think through the implications of every possible answer before I get back to you. So I can't answer you for at least 2 days.
Got it. So what and, sorry.
Yeah, so I mean we don't use questions. All right, so somebody says to me, what was the thing? It's too much. What was your example before?
So it's like it's
too we don't much. Have a budget for this.
Yeah, we don't have a budget for this. This is out of our budget range or something like that.
Right. So you want to demonstrate understanding. What do they tell you if they don't have the budget for it? They're telling you one of two things. They're either under pressure or what you're offering is not delivering adequate value.
Right, the value alignment, yep.
So a demonstration of understanding would be seek first to understand, then be understood, demonstrate understanding. Sounds like the value is just not there for you. They have just communicated to you very clearly that something's wrong with your proposition. And instead of you demonstrating any understanding of that in any way, shape, or form, instead you want to challenge them as if they weren't listening. Help me understand here, what's not here for you? Which is equivalent to saying, you know, you haven't been paying attention, so I'm gonna have to go back over my value proposition again because you're not paying attention. So let me see if I can isolate where you weren't paying attention so I can go back and correct you. I mean, that's what you're communicating when you say, help me understand what about this isn't valuable for you.
Okay.
And in most cases, a lot of people probably say it in a tone of voice that indicates that you think they're stupid.
Yeah.
So, but to say, sounds like the value is just not here for you, is an indication of understanding, and it's an invitation to fix it. And it's taking responsibility on your side to be responsive to them instead of them being responsive to you.
Cool. And what you're searching for is the that's right, not you're right. Right?
Well, exactly. At some point in time, if somebody's saying you're right to you, nice. They are trying to finish the interaction and go home. You want to go to lunch.
It's the same reason why you don't say I understand. Because what's the negative part of me? Like after you tell me, so there's one about summarizing and rephrasing back to you. But then after you tell me something and me saying I understand, what's the danger of that?
Well, all right, let's pretend like you actually do understand.
Right.
But when you say that, they're not clear on what you understand. I mean, you're trying to give them the Cliff Notes version of it. I mean, how do they, if you say, I understand, how do they know, how do they really know that they got their points across if you don't repeat back to them the points that they in fact got across? I mean, you know, since we were kids, we played the telephone game. You know, tell somebody a secret, by the time you tell four other people, the secret's completely changed. I mean, it's nearly impossible to hear somebody's side of things the first time and get it right. So to say I understand, even if you do, chances are, let's say you're the best listener in the world. Chances are you got it 80% right. And you're taking a real risk on a percentage that you got wrong. So I understand is, that's just too nebulous. You tell me that you understand, I'm not sure I'm getting a warm and fuzzy feeling that you actually do.
Gotcha.
And in most cases, I understand precedes, but here's where you're wrong. Mm-hmm.
Is it okay to say, let me make sure I heard you correctly, and then rephrase it back to them? Or is there a better way of summarizing what you heard from them that makes them more open to understand that you really do understand?
No, that's not bad at all. I mean, you know, we don't coach people to say it like that. There are other ways of saying it. I mean, let me make sure I heard you correctly is a command. And it's a grab at control again. And it's to take autonomy from the other side. And, you know, I mean, commands just, they just don't sit well with other people. I mean, if you're a frontline salesperson and your CEO sets you down, you might be a little bit slow to say, tell me more about that, or let me make sure I understand.
Yeah.
You know, you might want to demonstrate your understanding, or you might change your tone of voice. But, you know, we like deference to begin with, which is not to take control. You know, we love deference as an approach because there's great power in deference. I mean, we love deference. because everybody loves it. If I'm deferential to you, you're going to give me a lot more opportunity to talk because I'm deferential. You're going to feel like you can stop me at any time. I mean, we love deference.
So it's more in the sense of, it seems like instead of let me make sure I heard this correctly scenario.
Yeah. And again, tone of voice is going to make a big difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get away with a lot of bad words with great tone.
Yeah, you do.
You know, we were on a coaching call just the other day. And, you know, we coach people to identify negatives. Identifying a negative diffuses it. And people say, okay, that makes sense to me. And we say, and identifying a negative never plants it. And they go, okay, that makes sense to me. And then we say, all right, so let's be proactive. Let's say, all right, you're probably upset with us. They say, oh my God, that's, you know, they're going to respond to us. Well, I wasn't, but I am now. But wait a second, 2 seconds ago, you agreed that we couldn't plant negatives, and now you're arguing. So we get somebody arguing with us. And so I just stopped and I said, so it sounds like when I said identifying negatives doesn't plant them, you thought it was wrong? Now, listen, that my tone was clear there, right? Mm-hmm. And I could have said, so it sounds to me like when I said identifying negatives doesn't plant them, you thought I was wrong. Same words.
Much different.
Tone of voice on a second one kills me. But the first one, you know, the tone of voice makes all the difference in the world. I mean, I'm 1,000% convinced that, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort. And, you know, everybody wants to learn from Jordan Belfort.
God, no. Fuck no. Sorry.
And but they do, right?
Yeah.
So what was there to learn from him? In my view,
how to tone be an voice. Asshole. Yeah.
Well, the guy, I think the guy mastered tonality.
Did he?
I mean, 1,000, and clearly he mastered something because he wouldn't owe $100 million in restitution, which means he stole way more than that.
Uh-huh.
You know, but I mean, so what did he do? Because you take a look at straight line selling, and it's no matter what the client says, your widget is the answer. I mean, that by definition is not listening. So how did he get over so much? And in my view, the guy mastered tonality, and that is something that's fair for anybody to master. I'm not a fan otherwise. Don't get me wrong. I you know, the guy owes. The only reason that if you should ever consider buying his book would be to help give some of the $100 million back because he owes restitution based on book sales.
Yeah, tell me about it. I, whenever anybody asks me what my favorite sales movies are, you know, Wolf of Wall Street, Boiler Room, Glengarry Glen Ross, I tell them no. Those are literally the worst sales movies I've ever seen in my life. You know, they're great movies, they're funny, but they're literally everything that's wrong about selling. Everything that's wrong about selling. And I tell them to go look the two best sales movies. And actually, I'll finish with this. I want to understand what yours are. My two favorite sales movies, Pursuit of Happiness, right, with Will Smith.
Wow.
And Tommy Boy. You ever watched Tommy Boy?
I never thought of it as a sales movie, but you know, it's a great thought.
Watch it, because I talk about catching your sales groove, right? And there's a moment in every sales rep's life where they wake up and it's just a little bit easier today than it was yesterday, and you don't know when it was, but it's when you stop pitching your solutions and you start having conversations about your solutions.
Right.
Start caring more about the client's needs than you do about your commission check. And there's that beautiful moment in Tommy Boy where he catches his sales groove. He's like, Helen, you look like a Helen. Let me tell you why I suck as a sales rep. And he goes through this whole, like, Jojo, the idiot circus boy with a pretty new pet. And she's like, wow, you're twisted. You know, I'll go fire up those wings. Go, oh, Tommy, like you, Tommy, want wingy? You know, in that moment, he caught a sales groove. Because before that, he was pitching. He was trying to be like his dad. You could stick your head up a butcher's ass type of stuff, right? And couldn't figure it out. And then then it was just him. And it was empathy. It was self-deprecation. And so it's a beautiful sales movie if you get a chance to go see it again.
I'll probably go back and watch it again.
Yeah, go watch. You can put the sales lens on. Because, right, it's funny. At first, it's like, yeah, Tommy Boy, that's fun. You know, big fat guy making fun of himself. But look at it with the sales lens on. It's a blast. So.
That's really cool. Yeah. All right. Very good.
Do you have any favorite sales movies or anything like that? Or
look at it through a different lens. I look at it through negotiation, right? And as opposed to sales. But that's a lens I'm going to have to go back and take another look at it.
Awesome.
Okay, so listening to understand is what we're getting at here, okay? Listening is the most powerful tool in your toolbox. People don't realize that. But you don't get information if you're talking. So by itself, just listening to the other side can be persuasive, because some people will go all day long, especially if they're at work, and nobody listens to a thing that they say. So when you're in the negotiation with your counterpart and you're actually listening to what they have to say and you're labeling them and you're mirroring them and you're encouraging them to give you all kinds of information, they're feeling understood. Because in a negotiation, when you're trying to use tactical empathy, you should be seeking to understand the other side before you expect them to understand you. That's the whole big thing about it. You're showing deference to the other side. The other side is the most important. It's not about you. Nothing is about you. And you don't look for common ground. Okay. We're not big pushers of common ground. It's not going to matter if your son and their son both play t-ball together. It's not going to get you to an agreement faster. It's going to be like a little, your son plays t-ball. My son plays t-ball. That's not going to make them like you any better, honestly. Yeah, you have something in common. Doesn't matter. They have that in common with a million other people whose kids play t-ball. So common ground really isn't going to get you anywhere if there's not any kind of empathy behind it. So what we say is listen to what they have to say. Don't comment about yourself. The way I like to play it is I label and mirror someone and try to get as much information as possible from the other side, giving away as little as possible from me. That's just a tool that I use that helps me get to tactical empathy. Because it's very easy, even for those of us that have been using the skills for a long time and we're pretty well versed in this, it's very easy to get caught up in a conversation and all of a sudden, a lot of your stuff is being insinuated into the conversation. And if you're having some kind of a negotiation with a counterpart, you don't want that, okay? You want information from them. That's how you find the black swans, encouraging the other side to talk. So you label, you mirror, you listen to what they say, which lets you get to a deeper label and a deeper mirror, or not a deeper mirror, a deeper label, which will potentially lead you to a black swan. That's how they get uncovered, okay? The more you label, you get more information from the other side, that's when those unknown things are gonna come out that will change the whole scope of the negotiation. You can't get that information if you're the one doing all the talking, okay? You have to basically give the other side the chance to give you that information, okay? So listening is how you do that.
Talking about tactical empathy in your everyday life, one of the things you have to do is, you know, be curious, man. If you're curious and you're always looking for the why, it's going to cause you to be more engaging with the individual that you're dealing with. They're going to think you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. So be curious. If you're curious, people are going to say, wow, this person is one of the best listeners I've ever dealt with. They're going to start to like you, and the more they like you, the easier it's going to become. And that'll be part of your everyday life once you start doing it and you start realizing that it's who you are now. It won't be a chore. It won't be a challenge. It'll just be part of who you are.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Troy. And something I'll just to piggyback on the end of that. Every conversation you have, every single conversation you have, there isn't one interaction you're going to have that is outside of the realm of possibility for practice to get reps in. So outside of work, anytime you interact with another person. And then something else I add to it, a mental piece around curiosity. You got to flip your brain into a place where you are ready to verbalize understanding. Right? If mentally it's too taxing to get to a place where, like, all right, I'm just going to verbalize understanding here. That's all I'm going to do. Right? Which is really hard to do when we're already triggered or we're tired. It's the end of the day. We already got a lot of things on our mind. We just want to have the conversation, not put a lot of effort into it and move on to the next thing. Right? That happens to all of us. It's human nature. We all get bogged down. We all get fatigued. And in those moments, that's when it's that much more important to focus on actually being curious. And the reality is, this is going to be a harsh statement. If you're in a place where you don't want to mentally click into gear to perform at that level, you're going to continue to have conversations that don't get you anywhere. Right? We talked about this last week. We're still in the same spot. Did you verbalize an in-depth understanding in the last conversation? The answer to that is no. Then that's where the rubber meets the road, as it were. And so, yeah, it is, especially when you're just starting out and it isn't muscle memory, right? You're in a shoe, right? You're learning the basics. You're just getting off the ground. You're going to have to mentally switch your focus to a verbal understanding and genuine curiosity. And that feels like a very big step sometimes, right? For all the reasons I mentioned earlier, but that's perfect, Troy. And if you haven't heard this, I always suggest call up your most expensive utility and get a discount. It's a great way to practice where you got low stakes, but getting a win is going to be a big deal for you. That's an easy one to start practicing with. So continuing with our questions, kind of going around here, Derek, I'd love to throw this to you. Someone asked specifically. Hey, Bran,
please hold on to that challenge for Derek for a second, because you just gave me a bit of inspiration.
Sure. Yeah, Professor, if you got a thought, please feel free.
All right, so, you know, unofficially, today is International Tactical Empathy Day. And there's no shortage of stuff raging on social media as we speak. You know, whether it be American politics, whether it be international politics. You know, the Israeli-Palestinian thing is raging right now. It's raging so much, it's actually catching the attention of the American media, and the American media only really wants to pay attention to when we're tearing each other apart, because they love the rock throwing and they love the flame throwing that's going on. But, you know, whichever one of these issues you feel most passionate about, here's what I challenge you to do just today, just for today. You only got to do it today. You don't got to live this way. But International Tactical Empathy Day, find somebody's position on social media that you disagree with and wade into the conversation like this. Before I disagree with you, let me make sure I've got your perspective correct. And then with the curiosity that Brandon and Derek Brandon and Troy are talking about now, try and lay out their perspective until either you can't take it no more and you just quit, or until they tell you you've got it right. Until they say, that's right, you've got my perspective correctly. And keep it up until the one you're arguing with confirms whether that's right, or an agreement that you got it right. Now, this is likely going to be really hard and maybe even exhausting for you the first couple times you try it. So you can go back to your arguments tomorrow. But today, just for today, let's see how much of this tactical empathy madness we can inject into the raging that's going on in social media. See what happens. You want some practice where you got nothing at stake? Try it today. Just try it today.
You just recently opened an art gallery and just started in business?
No, I've had my business for 23 years.
And you deal with pushovers on a regular basis?
I deal with rich people. And
billionaires?
Billionaires, yes. And
they
also
used to get in their way?
They do get their way. They plow over everybody.
And you recently found a book. Your brother talked you into it.
Yes, I did.
Thank God you listened to your brother, because you didn't want to read the book.
I'm fairly successful, and I usually don't
have roadblocks. Fairly successful. I think you're ridiculously successful, right?
Well, I'm okay. I'm good. I'm lucky. But I had one situation that was really bothering me it was over 3 years, an agreement that had just not been honored. And I was trying every which way, in the ways I thought were natural to me, to basically
fix
push
it
back,
yeah.
You know, and the tougher he got, the tougher I got. And we
right
just kept going back and forth, and he had dug his heels in, and I was just basically punching the air for 3 years.
Yeah.
And then I read the book.
Yeah.
Thought, okay, I'm going to try it. And
yeah,
there's no way it's going to work, but I'm going to try it.
I'm going to try.
And literally within 7 days, I got a wire for $700,000.
You are awesome.
And I was shocked. Truly
you were
shocked.
Working on it for a year, and you solved
three
it
years
in seven, 3 years.
3 years.
Solved in 7 days.
This was outstanding. This issue, we couldn't come to a meeting of the minds.
Sound like you were outstanding.
I was not willing to cave, which I think is a shock on the other side. Yeah. They're used to people just caving. And right. I'm not a caver, but I wasn't going to let it
You grew go up in away. New York? You're from here? So you're a tough New York chick.
Kind of. So, and you think, you know, in the art world, you're dealing with art, that it's a very soft, lovely kind of, you know.
That'd be tough, right? Commodities dealers, commodities exchange, right?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, the numbers are real, and there's people that are affected if it's it's real money.
You having fun here today?
Yeah, it's great. Totally great.
You're at one of our special master classes?
So is that what that says?
It's a master class on tactical empathy.
Well, that
and you're having a good time.
I was thrilled to see that you're coming.
So. Thank you for coming today. We are grateful
and
that
actually,
you were here.
I need advice. I want to give this book to my sales team, but I'm afraid they'll use it on me. So how
do you think I have
that?
To deal with on a regular basis? Everybody in my company uses it on me. We work together, though. It's for great collaboration.
Yeah.
The whole purpose is, how do we create collaboration where the other side wants to collaborate or not? Because we got to collaborate.
So I have a negotiating approach, which is a win-win. If I win, I want everyone to win.
Yeah.
I have a lot of people that I do business with that they don't feel satisfied or that they've achieved anything unless there's a loser on the end of the deal. So they want a winner or loser. So
we let them feel that way. It's, okay. It's not what actually happened. It's how they felt about it.
Okay.
And we make people feel the way they want to feel like they got a great deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in this situation, this guy feels like he really got one over on me and I feel totally satisfied that I got the $700,000. Yeah. So yeah, truly.
Thank you.
Did you ever wonder what are the emotional intelligence secrets that FBI hostage negotiators use to get their way and whether or not they would do you any good in your business or personal negotiations? Because after all, if there's a bank robbery with hostages, which I've negotiated, and there's four hostages, does the hostage negotiator say, well, I'll tell you what, why don't we meet in the middle and we'll call it a day? You really can't compromise when you're a hostage negotiator, and that's the way that I learn negotiation. So I'll take you through a little bit of how I got to learn it and how I began to apply it in my business and professional life. And it really started on a night in late winter in New York City, well after dark. I left the FBI office, 26 Federal Plaza, and fought my way through traffic to get to a suicide hotline. I was volunteering on the suicide hotline because I've been told that was the best way to become a hostage negotiator, the best experience. And as a side note, I would tell you it's the best way to learn how to really listen to people on an emotional intelligence perspective. So I got to the hotline that night, and I picked up the phone, and I answered the phone, and my hotline voice, "Hello, this is Helpline," which came to be known as the late night FM DJ voice, which now I refer to as the late night FBI DJ voice. But the voice on the other end of the phone just blurted out. He says, I need your help. I need your help. I got to put a lid on this day. I got to bring a lid to this day. And I listened to him, and I sensed that he was frantic. So that's exactly what I said. I said, "You sound frantic." And immediately I could feel a change in his tone of voice. And his voice came down. I felt strength come into his voice. And he started to talk to me. And he began to tell me his issue was that he was battling the disease of paranoia. And he was going to go on a car trip the next day with his family. And he knew that on that car trip, because of his paranoia, he would get completely wound up and overcome with the paranoia. So since it was going to happen the next day, that night he was overcome with paranoia, thinking about the paranoia for the next day. And it completely wrapped himself up and needed to put a lid on the day. So as we began to talk, he began to tell me also about how much his family was helping him. And I used something that someone else had once said to me, and I remember how strong it was, because I was explaining to a colleague of mine how involved my family was and how supportive they were. And at that time, my colleague said to me, "It sounds like your family's really close." And when he said that to me, I remember how good it felt. and how it just drew together everything that I was feeling and how I felt myself strengthened when he said that. So I said to this, the same thing to this man on the phone. I said, it sounds like your family's really close. And he says, yeah, we are. And so then he began, and he continued to talk, and he talked, and he began to tell me all the things that he was doing in order to battle the paranoia. And I was very impressed with it. He sounded like a very determined man to me. So I said to him, you sound really determined. And he said, you know, I am determined. He said, you know, I'm going to go on that car trip tomorrow, and I'm going to be fine. Thanks for everything you did for me. And he hung up. Now, I said three things to him, just three simple things. And I didn't know it at the time. And I was explaining to a friend of mine at brunch just the other day. He was telling me he used to write for Hollywood. And he said, you know, what you're saying about what you do makes all the sense in the world. I never would have guessed what you were doing. But once you explain it, it makes all the sense in the world. It's like a great Hollywood ending. You have no idea what's coming at the end of a movie, but when it happens, it makes sense. And that's what hostage negotiators do. And we do now do in business. We take things that you all know about, but we combine them in ways that make them incredibly powerful that no one ever sees.
So the accusations audit is amazing because it gives you the freedom to do whatever it is that you needed to do, or to ask or address whatever it is that you came in needing to ask or address. And so if you're concerned that that this person already thinks that you're too assertive, right, already kind of has that preconceived notion about you, then you can just simply say, you're going to think that what I'm about to ask you is really assertive. You might say, you're going to feel really overwhelmed by what I'm about to ask you. You might say, if you're concerned that they're being, that you think that you're too emotional, that they think that you're too emotional. You might say, you're probably going to think that I'm bringing emotion into this. And so it helps if that person, you can tell that person already thinks that about you, by addressing that dynamic, you're able to diffuse it. There's a question in the chat that asked, well, what if that person didn't already think that? Is this going to make it worse? Sandy, yeah, I kind of want to hand that to you because I know you have a lot to say.
You can't plant a negative, okay? If they don't feel that way, they don't feel that way. You're not going to suddenly put that thought in their head, okay? And even if you do, you're mitigating at the same time. So it's not going to make it happen if it's not already there. So even if they're not thinking that whatever you're saying is going to be too expensive, and you're saying, well, you're going to think this is so expensive, and they're like, well, I mean, they might be thinking money's no object. All they're going to do is just say, well, no, not really, and just go on with the next thing. You're not going to plant that negative, okay? How you plant a negative is by saying, I don't want you to think I'm being picky, but I really don't like that shade of blue. Okay. You threw it out there. And what's the first thing they're going to think when they hear, I don't want you to think I'm being picky? They're going to think, oh, you're being picky. You know, I don't want you to be mad at me for doing this. So they know that whatever you're saying right now is going to make them mad. Okay. That's the wrong way to do it. So you don't want to do that's basically, that's the denial. You want to avoid the denial. You want to just point out the negative. You don't want to try and justify it or explain it. So just say, yeah, you may think I'm being picky. I don't like that shade of blue. Instead of saying, I don't want you to think I'm being picky, because that's telling them that they're going to be that way. Okay, that's not mitigating anything. That's actually raising it. So you want to be very careful that you word this correctly. But you cannot introduce the negative. If it's not already there, you're not going to make it be there because you're saying it. So don't be afraid of that. Okay.
Absolutely.
Do you have more to say about that preconceived notions?
No, just that. Yeah, that essentially a lot of times we come into these situations kind of fearing, like, well, that person already thinks this about me. How can I possibly talk to them about it? Or this person already believes that this isn't going to work. There's no convincing them. It is shocking the power of what an accusations audit can do. It demonstrates self-awareness. It demonstrates concern and care for the other side. Because essentially, when you are giving the accusations audit properly, the way Sandy was talking about, then what you're saying in essence is, I understand your experience right now, and I understand that I'm making this hard for you in some way. And so even if, you know, you're not really, because you're probably not being too emotional, or you're probably not being too assertive, that doesn't really matter, because it's that person's experience. And so then we're able to subvert those preconceived notions, move on, and continue to make a deal.
Let's talk about the fallacy of common ground for a moment. And let's talk about the kidnapping that I mentioned earlier. The first kidnapping I worked in the Philippines. Now, this is an American who's overseas doing something he shouldn't do. Now, he thinks he's got common ground going. He's an American, but he's living in the Philippines, so he's got literal common ground. He's there in the country. He also thinks it's a largely Muslim area because he's in the south of the Philippines, and he's a Muslim, so I got more common ground. We got religious common ground. He's dedicated to Islam. As a matter of fact, his understanding of the religion is in depth. He studied it in school. And those of you that either are Muslim or familiar with the Muslim religion, you know one of the many things to be admired about the religion is it prizes scholarship highly. It prizes knowledge of the religion. And Jeffrey has an in-depth knowledge of the religion. So he's got more common ground. And he's in love with a local female. Look at this. I'm not exploiting a local female. I'm actually in love with her and I've married her. That's common ground. So therefore, I know where the local terrorist group, the Abu Sayyaf, is coming from. I'm a good guy. I'm on your side. But it's eye-focused. Again, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. It's not about you. Empathy is not about you. How do they see you? They see him as a stupid American. Things he can take up with one of our women, which is highly offensive. It's not common ground. He's telling us what our religion is. We don't care if he's right. When was the last time somebody came into your house and started to explain your religion to you? Did you care that they were right? Simultaneously, compensation. There was a recent kidnapping in the area where a rival faction of this terrorist group got $20 million for the release of 20 Western European hostages. So at the end of the day, compensation plays a role. An American overseas doing something stupid. This is a sociopath that has him. The question I often get, or the one that I like to throw out, is, does empathy work on sociopaths? Well, this guy is a sociopath. He's got on his uniform. Sunglasses, black bandana, black t-shirt, camo pants, 45 strapped to his side, 45 caliber automatic handgun strapped to his side of his camouflage pants. He thinks this makes him look daring and dashing. He doesn't have on sunglasses because it's sunny in the south of the Philippines. It is, but he's got them on because he thinks it makes him look more photogenic. And this is the negotiator that I'm coaching. Now, we go through the negotiation for a period of months. The terrorist is not asking for ransom for the release of the American. He's asking for war damages for 500 years of oppression in the south of the Philippines, from the Spanish to the Japanese to the Americans. Now, right now you're saying like, well, this is one reason why hostage negotiation doesn't apply to me. Because I was never in a negotiation where the other side were bringing up things from the past that had nothing to do with me, that occurred to them before I ever showed up. In my business negotiations, people don't react like that. They don't bring baggage to the table. Oh, wait a minute. That happens in every negotiation. People bring their history of experience to the table, even history I had nothing to do with. So we finally decide, after 4 months of a stalemate, that we're going to get a that's right out of the terrorist. So I coach my negotiator, today you get a that's right. He gets a terrorist on the phone. He says, you know, you're not asking for ransom for the American. You're asking for war damages for 500 years of oppression. And he goes on at length over the injustices that occurred and the things that the other side had experienced. It had nothing to do with the Americans or the American being held, but what they had experienced. And after going on at length over the other side's experience, he goes silent. He doesn't offer an argument in return. He just goes silent. And the kidnapper on the other end of the phone says, that's right. He summarizes the other side's facts, not our facts, but their facts, and how they felt about the facts. And the kidnapper says, that's right. and the ransom demand goes away. It just goes away. Money is never mentioned again in the kidnapping. It takes several more twists and turns. And on Maundy Thursday, on the Thursday before Easter, the hostage walks away. The military flew down and picked him up. They held a big press conference in Manila announcing the rescue. We flew Schilling back, the American, back to the United States, and I was back in the Philippines a couple of weeks later. I connected back up with the negotiator that I had coached, and he said, "You're not going to believe who called me on the phone." I said, "I don't know who called you on the phone." "The sociopathic terrorist." "What did he say?" He said, "Have you been promoted yet?" "I don't know what it was," he said to me on the phone. "I was going to kill the American. You're really good at what you should do, what you do. They should promote you." This is what the demonstration of understanding gets, ladies and gentlemen, because in that moment, the person who lost everything called the person on the phone responsible for it to congratulate him and let him know that he was still willing to talk to him. Despite everything that happened, he was still willing to talk and collaborate should they talk again. Everybody that you interact with should always be willing to talk with you, because your brand is empathy. Your brand is understanding. That's what That's Right does. When you begin to apply this to all of your interactions, people will always be willing to talk with you. Your brand is empathy. Your best self is relayed to others through the use of empathy.
So you got employees that, again, are not listening to what you say. They're not executing. They're not batteries included, right? They don't take initiative. They essentially wait for the boss to do this thing before they take action at all. And so what do you do? And so some of this, I would say, is going to be solved by an accusations audit. What is causing them to not execute in the way that is most desirable? Some of that's going to be based on what's going on in your environment. And so it might have to do with fairness. It might have to do with they don't feel like they're being put on the right projects, or they feel like whatever's being assigned to them is beneath them, or the way that they're being assigned is they may see it as being disrespectful. It could be any number of things. But going in with an accusations audit of "you probably feel this way" is going to leave you in one of two places. You're just going to say, "You know what, boss, that's exactly right. This is the way I wish that it worked out." Or they're going to say, "Boss, that's not actually it at all. It's this other thing." What does that tell you? You're going to be better informed by leading with the accusations audit, because you're either going to be exactly on the money, or they're going to say, "No, that's not actually how I see it. I see it like this, boss. This is what I need you to know as your employee." Any additional thoughts that you would add to that specific one there, Derek?
Setting your clear expectations, summarizing the conversation, and once you have got an understanding / agreement as to what the execution of whatever looks like, you're going to want to rule of three. There are three types of yeses that you get from anybody, and that's counterfeit, confirmation, and commitment. And so once you've come to that understanding, that's your first yes. You're going to want to hit that yes at least twice more to make sure that you guys are on the same page. A yes without a how is worthless. So when they say, "Yes, boss, got it, I'm on my way," and they go out and execute and they don't come back, it's ultimately your fault, because you didn't get the confirmation yes and you didn't get the commitment yes. How do you get those commitment and confirmation yeses? Just simply label, mirror, or paraphrase what has just been said. They tell you, "Boss, I'm going to have this project to you by next Tuesday. Sounds like next Tuesday is a better day for you." Yes, that's your second yes. Your third yes is going to be, "So if I understand you correctly, next Tuesday, by Monday night, you will have all of this thing wrapped up. And on Tuesday morning, when I come in, it'll be in my inbox waiting for my approval." Something to that effect. That's your third yes. And so once you've gotten them to, those are public promises, and it's very hard, not impossible, but it's hard for people to go back on a promise that has been verbalized, that has been vocally stated. So when they speak it into the air, it's like going into a tablet with a chisel.
yes, tone is going to be important. Again, circumstance drives your strategy. Generally, your tone in a situation with the accusations audit is, you don't necessarily want to have a curiosity tone, because the things you lace in your accusations audit are things that you're sure of. You probably feel like you're getting passed up when you shouldn't be. It might even seem like, you know, you've been ignored, or your real talents haven't been taken into account, right? You want to say it as almost a declarative tone. You want to say it as though you know it to be truth. This is how, as almost to say, this is how I know you see the world. When you wake up in the morning, the sky looks green, the sun is purple, and there's giraffes in your yard. Right? That might not be true from your point of view. That doesn't change what they see. So yeah, declarative tone. You want them to know that you see it also. These are also things that I see to be true.
When they have a valid argument, but it's not appropriate for the specific situation, find out what's the motivation. Seems like you have a reason for saying X, and find out what their thinking was. And then I would follow that with a no-oriented question. Would it be a bad idea if I explained why that's not appropriate in this instance? Again, you're deferring, you're asking permission to give an explanation. And then you lay it out. And then you lay out what would be appropriate for that situation. How do you lay that one out? With another no-oriented question. Are you against? And then fill in the blank. What is appropriate for that situation? So I would listen to their side, label, mirror, paraphrase, and then come up with a no-oriented question. Are you against whatever it is for the appropriate situation? Would it be a bad idea if I explained to you why this was not appropriate?
In regards to the survey results, new manager recently promoted, unfortunately got promoted over someone in the organization that someone felt like they deserved the promotion because they've been around longer. But the reality is this individual got promoted because they're a go-getter, they're crushing it, they're killing it. And so the residual effects of that is they're dealing with a coworker who is now a subordinate that is now being very disruptive. Doesn't want to have a decent conversation, sees them probably as the enemy in the office because they got passed up by this person. And so, Derek, what would you offer this person as far as being able to solve that with this individual who is now a subordinate, who seems to be very obstinate because they feel like they got passed up for the promotion that they deserve?
All right. So there's a lot there to work with, but a thumbnail sketch of what it should look like would be, you're going to have to address it. You're going to have to address the counterproductive behavior because it impacts your credibility as a leader. So you're going to have that one-on-one. How are you going to start that one-on-one? You're going to hit them with the accusations audit. I know that you don't have a lot of faith in me as a leader. I know you think that I'm probably not worthy of the position. Blah, blah, blah. So you're going to string them out. And there's a lot there that you can throw into an accusations audit. Last week during the meeting, I asked you to introduce yourself and you refused to do so. What caused that? Get the response, label later, paraphrase response. Again, you're showing that tactical empathy, and then you're going to hit them with the I message to address the counterproductive behavior without sounding accusatory. When you display that type of insubordination in front of others, I feel frustrated because it undermines me as a leader. When you, I feel because, is a perfect way for you to tell this person, knock it off. I'm not going to stand for it anymore. And then the conversation can be switched into what your relationship is going to look like going forward, what the ramifications are going to be if the behavior is repeated in the future. So again, you see the sequencing. Tactical empathy first, your goal and objective last. In the middle of that, we sandwiched in an I message, which is used to confront counterproductive behavior without sounding confrontational, without accusing the other side. You're telling them to knock it off without actually using the words, knock it off.
You do not want to refute any of your accusations, right? You don't want to say, you probably feel like I haven't given you a fair shake. But as your boss and having all these other things to consider, you know, what you didn't see was that all this other data that I had to look at in order to make the decision, right? That's refuting your accusations on it. So exactly to your point, you never want to put your butt in somebody else's face. I'm sure you feel this way, but this is actually what it is. That's what you want to leave out. If but and or because comes to mind during your accusations audit, you probably just want to replace it with silence. Don't let the words come out of your mouth. Don't refute them, because it's what those words do is it negates everything that came before.
What is tactical empathy? So tactical empathy is applying emotional intelligence in a very calibrated way. That's why we say tactical empathy. If you think about the word tactical, it essentially means that you're aiming at something beyond the immediate action. Okay, so beyond the label that you're using, beyond the mirror that you're using, you're aiming for tactical empathy in the long run, which is going to help you achieve that trust-based influence. So when you're talking about what it is about tactical empathy that makes it important, it's essentially recognizing the perspective of the person across the table from you and actually vocalizing that perspective. So it's not enough just to recognize what the other side is seeing. It is important for you to actually vocalize it, because you're not demonstrating the actual empathy until after you vocalized it. So if you think about, a lot of people say your gut instinct, or some people talk about, you know, that little voice in the back of your head, or when you're walking down the street and you feel the little hairs on the back of your neck kind of go up a little bit. If you pay attention to those things, those are where you're going to reach your intuition. Okay. You have to learn how to trust your gut, in other words, to use this stuff, to use these skills, you have to have a little bit of trust in yourself to kind of allow yourself to recognize what's going on with the other side. You can't be afraid of it. Now, the reason trusting your intuition is, why can I not talk today? Let me take another sip of coffee real quick. Let's see what we got going on here. My words are just trying not to come out right. The reason it is so important to learn how to trust your intuition is because your conscious mind processes 40 bits of information per second. Your unconscious mind processes 20 million bits of information per second. So there's a big disparity in that number. 40 bits of information, not really that much. When you're talking about how many things your unconscious mind is picking up each second, you get a lot of information if you learn how to trust that. Okay. All right. So a lot of people say, well, what's the difference? Isn't empathy the same as sympathy? No, they're not the same. Okay. Sympathy is when you're feeling what the other side is feeling. That's not what we're doing with empathy. Empathy is basically seeing the world through their eyes and then understanding it so well that you could summarize it for them. So I want you to remember as we go through here, it's not about being nice. It doesn't mean you agree with that other person. And it doesn't mean that you necessarily even like them. Because if you think about the world that Troy and Barbara and I come from, we didn't like the people that we were dealing with. Okay. They were usually bad people. So there was no love there with those people. So it's not that you have to feel any kind of positive way toward the person that you're dealing with. You just have to be able to demonstrate an understanding of what's going on in their mind and then be able to kind of vocalize it and summarize it for them.